The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Yonkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. The next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Heart Letter and also from the Harvard Health Letter. I'm going to start out with the Harvard Heart Letter. This is the issue of March 2022. The first article is entitled, Under Pressure, How Stress May Affect Your Heart. In some people with heart disease, mental stress can curtail blood flow to the heart, boosting the risk of heart attack. If you're suddenly thrust into a stressful, anxiety-provoking situation, your heart may speed up and your blood pressure may rise. But if you have heart disease, emotional stress may also hinder blood flow to parts of your heart. This phenomenon, called mental stress ischemia, may more than double the risk of heart attack, according to a new study. The study, the largest and most diverse of its kind to date, helps illuminate the connection between stress and heart disease, which was first described a century ago. The findings clearly show that mental stress ischemia is an important health problem, says Dr. Ahmed Tawakkol, Director of Nuclear Cardiology and co-director of the Cardiovascular Imaging Research Center at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. The fact that this study includes a sizable number of women is important, he adds. Mental stress ischemia appears to be caused in part by changes in the wall and inner lining of the heart's smallest blood vessels. Known as microvascular disease, this problem tends to be more prevalent in women than in men. However, narrowing of the large arteries of the heart is more common cause of chest pain in both women and men. Picture the blood supply to the heart as a tree, where the large blood vessels on the heart surface are the tree trunk and major branches, Dr. Tawakkol says. As they dive into the heart, the large vessels branch into smaller and smaller arteries. The heart's tiniest vessels, called the microvasculature, are like the tree's twigs or even the veins on a leaf, with the leaves representing areas of heart muscle. If you look up into a tree and see disease in one of the large limbs, the leaves at the end of that branch will be affected, says Dr. Tawakkol. But you might also see disease in the vessels of a leaf, and that leaf will still be affected, even if the large supporting branch looks okay. In some people with heart disease, both the large and small arteries are diseased or dysfunctional. They might experience chest pain during exercise as well as during mental stress. Earlier studies have shown that people with both microvascular disease and narrowing of the coronary arteries face the highest risk of future heart problems, says Dr. Tawakkol. In this study as well, those with the highest risk were the people who had both mental stress ischemia as well as exercise-induced ischemia. I'm going to turn back to the rest of this article. While this study sheds lights on how mental stress affects the heart, many questions remain. For example, would it be helpful to screen people for mental stress ischemia? Advanced heart imaging studies are now making it easier to detect subtle changes in blood flow throughout the heart, and can detect microvascular disease as well as narrowing of the large coronary arteries. Such tools could potentially further our understanding, Dr. Tawakkol says. But a more important question is whether people can do anything to blunt the negative effects of mental stress on their hearts. To find out, he and colleagues are conducting a study in which volunteers with and without heart disease will follow an 8-week stress management and resilience training program. Developed at the Benson Henry Institute for Mind-Body Medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital, the program teaches people self-care practice to better manage stress. A central focus involves learning to evoke the relaxation response, a simple mind-calming practice that counteracts the body's response to stress. Participants will undergo specialized brain and heart imaging tests before and after the training. We suspect the training will tilt the balance to cause less sympathetic nervous system activity, the fight or flight response in response to stressful events, says Dr. Tawakal. That in turn may reduce inflammation and other harmful effects of stress on all parts of the cardiovascular system, all the way down to the tiniest vessels. Results from the study aren't expected for at least several years, but other than a small time investment, there is no downside to practicing stress-busting techniques on your own. And attached to this is a short article called Mental Stress and the Heart, A Closer Look. Emotional or mental stress triggers physical changes throughout the body, and the heart is no exception. About 1 in 6 people with heart disease experiences decreased blood flow to the heart at times of mental stress. But does mental stress ischemia raise the risk of heart attack and related problems? A study published November 9, 2021 in JAMA explored this question. It looked at 918 people with heart disease with an average age of 60. 1/3 were women and 40% were black. All participants underwent 2 separate tests to see how stress, physical and mental, affected blood flow to the heart. For most, the physical test was a conventional exercise stress test done on a treadmill. About 30% instead received a medication to stress the heart. For the mental stress test, participants were given a topic and had 2 minutes to prepare a 3-minute speech to deliver to an audience of at least 4 people. About 1/3 of the participants had ischemia on the exercise stress test, and 16% experienced ischemia during mental stress. 10% had ischemia during both tests. Over the following 5 to 6 years, researchers tracked participants' rate of heart attack, heart failure hospitalization, and death from cardiovascular disease. Compared with people with no ischemia, those with mental stress ischemia were twice as likely to have a heart attack or heart failure during the follow-up period. Those with physical and mental stress ischemia had 4 times the risk. The risk increased only slightly among people with just physical ischemia. Now we're going to continue with the Harvard Heart Letter from March 2022, and we're going to look at a section called Ask the Doctor by Dr. Deepak L. Bhatt, MD, who is the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Heart Letter. The question asks, when I had a heart attack late last year, I got a stent in one of my coronary arteries. My doctor said that complications from stents are uncommon. But what can go wrong? Since the mid-1980s, when the first coronary stent was deployed, these tiny mesh metal tubes have undergone a series of improvements. These refinements have helped to minimize the risk of stent-related complications, which fall into 2 categories. One is a gradual re-narrowing of the area inside the stent that is called restenosis. The other is the formation of clots inside the stent, called stent thrombosis. Doctors deliver coronary stents by threading a slender tube or catheter through a vessel in the wrist or upper thigh all the way to the heart. At the tip of the catheter is a small balloon with a stent. Once the catheter reaches the area in the artery narrowed by fatty plaque, the balloon inflates and deploys the stent. The stent holds the artery open, restoring blood flow. At first, stents were made of bare metal, but sometimes cells from the inner artery wall grew over and around the metal, like a scab on a wound. Known as restenosis, the process can end up blocking blood flow through the artery, causing chest pain, and in some cases, a heart attack. To prevent that problem, researchers develop stents that release a drug that slows cell overgrowth. But early drug-eluting stents sometimes prevented any cells from covering the stent. As a result, blood clots would form on the stent, causing what was called stent thrombosis. That's why people who receive stents typically take anti-clotting medications for at least 6 months, sometimes a year, sometimes longer. Today's stents feature different drugs that minimize the risk of both complications, although anti-clotting pills are still necessary. Restenosis is most likely to occur during the first 3 to 12 months of receiving a stent. The artery can be reopened with a procedure similar to the original stent placement, although doctors sometimes need to use a tiny drill or laser to cut through the obstruction. Bypass surgery is also possible. It involves creating a new route around the blocked artery with a blood vessel taken from the chest, arm, or leg. Stent thrombosis can happen anytime, but most clots form within the first month of receiving a stent. Skipping or stopping the anti-clotting medication is the biggest risk factor for stent thrombosis. Be sure to adhere to your doctor's recommendation regarding those medications, along with any others you take for heart disease, like drugs to lower blood pressure and cholesterol. The next article again comes from the Harvard Heart Letter for March of 2022, and it's entitled, Should You Track Your Atrial Fibrillation Triggers? Trying to pinpoint what sets off episodes of atrial fib may be more trouble than it's worth, but alcohol appears to be a common culprit. The hallmark sign of atrial fibrillation, a chaotic racing heartbeat, often comes and goes. Episodes may last anywhere from seconds to hours, or even days before the heart rate spontaneously returns to normal. Some people with this form of atrial fibrillation, called paroxysmal or intermittent atrial fibrillation, don't even realize they have the disorder, but others experience a host of unpleasant symptoms: breathlessness, dizziness, anxiety, weakness, fainting, confusion, and fatigue. People with AFib often wonder whether certain habits, like drinking coffee or not getting sufficient sleep, might trigger their episodes. That curiosity inspired a collaborative clinical trial between researchers and patients to see whether pinpointing individual personalized triggers was possible and potentially helpful. Much of the media coverage of this study quoted doctors who suggested that people with AFib experiment on themselves to identify their AFib triggers. But that's not necessarily a good idea. It's mostly an exercise in frustration, says Dr. Peter Zimmetbaum, professor of cardiovascular medicine at Harvard Medical School and a specialist in heart rhythm disorders. When people try to identify their triggers, they spend a lot of time being hypervigilant about everything they do. More often than not, they can't find any correlation between their habits and when they experience AFib, he explains. That level of vigilance often ends up increasing their stress level. If they do identify potential triggers, they may find that avoiding triggers doesn't always help. The perceived lack of control can also heighten stress levels. People may recognize certain patterns to their atrial fib episodes. Some notice that disruptions to their normal routine will trigger a bout of AFib, like exhaustion from jet lag or indigestion after eating a rich, heavy meal. These problems perturb the body's autonomic nervous system, the network of nerves that control automatic functions, including your heart rate, breathing, and digestion. But when it comes to common habits like drinking coffee or alcohol, it's hard to disentangle their effects from the myriad other factors intertwined with those habits. These include environmental elements, the time of day or day of the week, or behavioral reasons, a desire to wake up or to relax. Some people are exquisitely sensitive to caffeine, but most are not, says Dr. Zimmetbaum. I tell my patients it's fine to have small amounts of caffeine because the link between caffeine and atrial fib is quite weak. As for alcohol, binge drinking, in other words, consuming a large amount of alcohol in a short time, is a well-known AFib trigger. But evidence increasingly suggests that smaller amounts of alcohol, even just one drink, may also raise a person's risk, and some people are more susceptible than others. And then there's a short piece that amplifies on this article. It's called Alcohol, Not Caffeine, is Fingered as a Common AFib Trigger. The iStop AFib trial included 446 people with paroxysmal atrial fib who were given a smartphone-linked device to use when they thought they were experiencing AFib. The device detects AFib by recording the heart's electrical activity via two fingers placed on a sensor. Half the participants simply tracked their AFib episodes for 6 weeks. The other half tested whether self-selected triggers might be causing their irregular heartbeats. Each person chose from a list of triggers, including caffeine, alcohol, reduced sleep, exercise, lying on the left side, dehydration, large meals, and cold food or drink. Then they exposed themselves to the potential trigger during 3 separate weeks and avoided the trigger for the next 3 weeks. After 6 weeks, they could review their results to see which, if any, triggers increased their AFib episodes. Then, over the next 4 weeks, they made lifestyle changes to avoid that trigger. During that time, the trigger tracking group had 40% fewer episodes of atrial fib compared with the monitoring only group. Most of this difference was driven by people who selected alcohol, dehydration, or exercise as their triggers. In fact, alcohol was the only trigger consistently linked to more bouts of AFib. And while people were most likely to choose caffeine as a potential trigger, the findings didn't support that suspicion. Researchers found no evidence that knowing one's triggers and heading off bouts of AFib could improve a person's quality of life. Next, also on Harvard Heart Letter, is an article that should have some practical tips. That's entitled, Build a Better Breakfast. Go beyond toast and coffee and include more heart-healthy nutrients in your morning meal. Many studies have linked eating breakfast to better health, including a lower risk of heart disease. But does breakfast itself deserve the credit? Or do habitual breakfast eaters have other healthy habits that explain the association? It's hard to say for sure, but nutrition experts agree that having breakfast is a good opportunity to eat some of the nutrient-rich foods you need for keeping your heart in good shape. Eat more whole grains instead of refined carbs, and choose healthy protein sources with more unsaturated fat and less saturated fat, says Linda Antinoro, a dietitian at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. First, they talk about toast toppers. If toast is your thing, make sure you're using a whole grain bread. Even if the label says multi-grain or 12-grain, it's not necessarily whole grain. You need to look for 100% whole grain or 100% whole wheat. To stave off mid-morning hunger pangs, add some protein. Try nut butters or a part-skim ricotta cheese. Slice a banana, an apple, or a pear on top, or have a piece of fruit on the side. The ever-popular avocado toast is another healthy choice because the pale green flesh of this fruit is packed with healthy fat and fiber. But a whole avocado can have close to 400 calories, so just use half of one, advises Liz Moore, who's a dietitian at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. To boost flavor, add a squeeze of lemon and a sprinkling of black pepper, garlic powder, and sunflower seeds. What about cereals? Well, oatmeal is a good choice because this whole grain cereal helps to lower LDL. Skip the individual instant oatmeal packets, which are often loaded with sugar. Just mix a third a cup of rolled oats with two-thirds of a cup of low-fat milk and heat it in a microwave for 2 minutes. Or combine oats and milk in a jar, shake, and leave in a refrigerator overnight. You can warm it up or not in the morning. You can dress up oatmeal in a variety of ways by adding nuts, seeds, fresh or dried fruit, and cinnamon. Try different combinations like walnuts, flax seeds, and blueberries or pistachios, chia seeds, and chopped dried apricots. Many popular ready-to-eat cereals, including granola, are high in sugar, so they're not ideal, says Moore. But if you miss the taste and texture of your favorite cold breakfast cereal, try adding a few tablespoons on top of your oatmeal, she suggests. Decades ago, eggs were assumed to increase heart disease risk because of their high cholesterol content. But we now know that for most people, dietary cholesterol doesn't affect blood cholesterol nearly as much as the total mix of fat in the diet does. The ideal mix includes mostly polyunsaturated and monounsaturated fat, with limited amounts of saturated fat. The modest amount of fat found in eggs is mostly unsaturated. In addition, two large observational studies found that in healthy people, eating up to one egg a day might not be associated with a higher risk of heart disease. One of the problems with eggs is the company they often keep. People tend to eat eggs with bacon or sausage or with white toast and butter, says Antinoro. These side dishes are the least healthy parts of the meal, she notes. Instead, pair eggs with vegetables. An easy way to do this is to make egg muffins, which you can freeze and quickly reheat in the microwave. And there's a brief recipe for healthy egg muffin cups. It says, preheat the oven to 350, spray a 12-cup muffin tin with a nonstick cooking spray, and whisk together 10 eggs with a few pinches of salt. You can also add black pepper and onion powder if you want to. Then chop up your favorite vegetables like broccoli, tomatoes, and onions. Grate a half to 1 cup of hard cheese. Divide the vegetables, cheese, and eggs evenly into the 12 muffin cups and bake for 20 to 25 minutes. Store in the refrigerator for 4 days or in the freezer for up to 1 month. And then I'm going to read a brief article. It's called Curbing Pollution's Harms. Two strategies are useful for people who have heart disease and are at risk for it. Check your local air quality. The Environmental Protection Agency provides real-time information about air quality throughout the country. You can find this at www.airnow.gov. That's AIRNOW. If the air quality is poor, just stay indoors. If you need to go outside, wear an N95 mask, the same kind that's recommended to prevent COVID-19 transmission indoors. It filters out fine airborne contaminants. Also, consider using a portable air cleaner. These devices can improve indoor air quality, which can be affected by outdoor pollution, especially wildfire smoke. Choose one that has a high clean air delivery rate matched for the size of your room. Remember to routinely change the filter on your air purifier and on any window or central air conditioner unit to improve air quality and to lower energy use. In addition, everyone, regardless of heart health, should work on cutting pollution production by walking, riding a bicycle, carpooling, or using public transportation. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.